Hello, this is Chiko Matsusaka, and welcome to Mission Artists. We are hearing today from Andrew Lane, musician, conductor, educator, and craftsman. I knew him as our principal pops conductor and youth orchestra director here in Sarasota, but over the years, I came to learn and appreciate the many facets of Andy's skill set. When I talked to Andy during the interview, he used the word accidental a lot in reference to the skill sets he's acquired over the years. But in reality, they might just be the right combination of timing, opportunity, and maybe a bit of destiny. But the results definitely fit mission artist qualities. Humility to the learning process, adaptability, and creativity.
I think in almost any musician has got a similar story where maybe they came into playing their instrument almost by accident, you know, the accidental musician. And that definitely happened with me too in seventh grade. My dad found out that shop class was offered and wanted me to be in shop class and pushing the idea of learn a trade. Shop class was full because apparently everybody wanted to be in shop class, and they stuck me in band. And so time I was in band was I really just thought I was waiting for an opening in shop class. So I didn't pay attention. I wasn't really interested. By the time it became obvious that a shop class opening wasn't going to happen, pretty much everybody had their instruments already chosen. And the only thing really left was French horn. And so I ended up playing French horn for that reason only. Plus, it only cost 10 bucks a year to play French horn in the public school system at that point. And again, I think the thing that would resonate with a lot of musicians is, you know, I was better at that than I was at some other thing. I was better at playing the instrument than I was at schoolwork. I was better than at sports. And so it was a good feeling. It was, wow, I actually can do this. So I really think that was the reason you stick with something, because you feel like you're good at it. And that's how it started for me.
So while Andy's introduction to music started out feeling like bad timing, it turned out to be the start of a great story. A vital part of learning a craft and skill is mentorship, and this accidental journey into music led Andy to cross paths with people like Linda Groh, the orchestra director at Brandon High School. I mention this because Andy pays tribute to her in a series of video interviews he did, which are available on YouTube. And these interviews are a measure of just how important music education can be for many students like Andy, and the power that a good mentor can have on the lives of younger people. Mentors not only guide and inspire, but they give purpose.
When you're lucky enough to have mentors that help you and inspire you to go to the next level, again, all those things kind of fell into place for me. And going on to college and getting my first job when I was just turned 21, my first full-time job when I turned 21. And again, being in a situation with the United States Navy Band in Washington, D.C., which was the musicians in the Navy Band were really excellent players and very consistent players. And that's something that I needed to work on in my playing, was the consistency. And lucky for me, I got in and was able to do that. And then being in a place like Washington, D.C., where you have so many other opportunities to play in other orchestras, when I finally got out of the Navy, I stayed in Washington for 2 years freelancing full time and playing a variety of things, playing shows, playing National Gallery Orchestra, American Chamber Orchestra, Fairfax Symphony. So there was always somewhere to go, which was really, I wouldn't have wanted to do that forever, but it was a great learning experience. The measure of success when you're a freelance musician is 3 gigs a day. That's not good for anybody.
After leaving behind the hectic and unpredictable nature of freelancing, Andy won a full-time position with the Florida Symphony in Orlando. However, the symphony was struggling financially, and Andy was once again finding himself in an accidental situation.
When the Florida Symphony went out of business in 1993, I had only been in the orchestra full time for 2 years at that point. I had a 1 year position, and then finally the last 2 years. And I had also just become chairman of the orchestra committee, and the orchestra was struggling for both of those 2 years I was full-time. And we talked about it as crisis management a lot, you know, just trying to get through the next month with the orchestra. So I think everybody in the orchestra felt concerned at losing something that was important for their livelihood, but also important, something they had worked so hard to get. And so when the orchestra unfortunately did go out of business, some people left the area. A lot of people stayed. And I think there were a few people that were willing to pretty much give up everything to try to come together and spend their time building something back. And the real challenging part of that was is we didn't have a clue as to what to do. So that was a learning experience. But there were a lot of really good people that came together for the sole reason of keeping some kind of symphonic orchestra alive in Orlando. It was interesting because at that time in Orlando in 1993, we had an arts umbrella. We had a funding organization called United Arts. And the orchestra was the largest arts organization under that umbrella. And it took a lot of United Arts money fundraising to support the orchestra. The orchestra was involved in the fundraising too, obviously. So bringing an orchestra back into the community with the idea that it was going to drain that fundraising from United Arts again was really a challenge. So the community wanted an orchestra, but the big question was, did the community want that kind of orchestra again? Of course, we did. And I remember I talked to the mayor of Orlando at one time about it. And she said, you know, you just need to duke it out with United Arts. That was not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear the mayor say, yeah, I'm in your corner. Let's do this. You know, so it was a struggle. To some extent, we did it. It's disappointing that the orchestra has not been able to reach even close to the same level it was back in 1993. Other orchestras around the state have grown. Orlando has not done so well. But as far as the community is concerned, yes, there was a symphonic orchestra in Orlando. There's a new concert hall in Orlando, which is great. So certainly good things happen. But, you know, it's always a work in progress.
In addition to being part of the reorganization of the Florida Symphony into the Orlando Phil, Andy agreed to take on conducting duties, believing it was simply part of what was needed at the time.
Stepping in for the Orlando Philharmonic, at the time they needed somebody to do park concerts and young people's concerts and things like that, I felt it would be temporary. I felt as soon as we got our footing, of course, they would replace me, and it was just part of trying to get the orchestra going again, really. But then they didn't, and my role became more with the orchestra, and the board wanted to call me resident conductor, which I welcomed because I wanted to have the title. And then the Southern Ballet Theater at that time needed a conductor for their programs and started with Nutcracker, and they had a nice season. They did 3 full ballets a year, and that was incredibly difficult. So it was a quick learning ground for me. So I kind of got catapulted into that world pretty quickly. And then after that, I mean, I've probably done 300 performances of Nutcracker since then.
The change from player to maestro offered new job opportunities for Andy, but it also offered a new point of view that has shaped the way he works with orchestras. And that's with efficiency, humor, and empathy.
Nutcracker in the Pit. Yeah. It's just funny because, wow, that's interesting to think about, because playing in the pit, you go through all these emotions playing in the pit. You're kind of irritated because you either hear too well or you don't hear well enough and all this stuff. And you never think about how difficult it is to control an orchestra and a ballet company on stage at the same time. It's quite a different thing to be a player in a pit and be a conductor in a pit. It's very different. I just can't believe how unaware I was. The first time I conducted a full ballet, you know, it hits you that at any given time, there's going to be dozens and dozens of people dancing on stage, and you could really mess it up for them. So, yeah, it was definitely a very quick process going from conducting a few concerts a year to conducting quite a bit.
Reaching back to where he began, Andy found himself drawn into music education. It was an opportunity to pass on what his mentors gave to him and to create what he describes as a layered legacy.
The Florida Symphony Youth Orchestra was started in, I think, in the 1960s by the concertmaster of the Florida Symphony Orchestra. So it's called the Florida Symphony Youth Orchestra, but it wasn't directly affiliated with the Florida Symphony other than Florida Symphony being kind of a mentor group to the youth orchestra. So they were always 2 separate organizations, but Orlando being so large community, youth orchestra grew pretty quickly, and before long, had two 80-piece orchestras, and that was probably in 1990. So that was pretty significant. And the youth orchestra played, even at that time, played challenging repertoire. So there was a lot of forward motion in the organization, really, since the first day. It's still happening today. They hired me to do the younger of the two orchestras. So they called it Orchestra 1 and Orchestra 2. And Orchestra 2 was made up of high school and middle school age kids. Well, it was probably a really good thing for me, but not a great thing for them, because I knew so little about string playing and they needed so much help. So really, I think I was the lucky one there. And we kind of grew together, I think. And it was a great opportunity, but it was also good that I knew I needed to learn some things that I certainly was lacking. And so it helped advance me, I think, as much as it helped them. But then I eventually became the conductor of the most advanced orchestra. And that was an incredible experience. I did that for 17 years. And being part of the organization, while it grew not only in numbers, by the time 2005, we had four orchestras. So it was growing in numbers, but it was growing in talent and playing major orchestral repertoire like Mahler symphonies and Shostakovich symphonies. And it became an inspiring thing for me just to hear these young players advance in the course of a season and put this challenging music in front of them was just really kind of an amazing thing. And I always would say to myself, you know, there's three answers to a question is, can they play this music? Well, if the answer is no, that's too bad. If the answer is yes, that's good. But if the answer is maybe, that's maybe the best, because you're putting something in front of them that they have to stretch a little bit musically to get there. For me, music, self-esteem wise, was just incredibly important. And I'm sure a lot of people would agree with that. And I can remember that when you're learning a piece of music, when there's a new piece of music in front of you, you get so excited about it, you want to run out and you want to get a recording, you want to hear it played by a professional orchestra. And I think that becomes layers. It happens with one generation moves it to the next spot, and then another generation builds on it. And I kind of feel like the youth orchestra, for me, putting all that together, what I learned from my teachers, and then hopefully what they learned from me, and then what they take forward, is kind of just a layered process that kind of transcends communities even. But also with a youth orchestra, you're building an audience. You know, these players don't go off and necessarily be musicians on the professional level, but they are always musicians, and they have an appreciation of music that comes back to the concert hall as an audience member. So if you look at it in that perspective, there's never a time that teaching a Brahms symphony to a young player doesn't make sense, because whether they go off to play it Brahms again or whether they just go off to listen to Brahms again in the concert hall, it's something that they take with them when they graduate from high school or college or whatever.
Another legacy Andy is creating is the craft of building French horns with one of his sons. I'll also add that he's managed to bring that missed shop class back into his life.
For some reason, I call it Landstro instead of Lanestro, and I don't really have a good reason why. But Landstro is the combination of Lane and Maestro kind of hooked together. And it's actually a name that I used for a recording business that I had for a while. And so when I decided to start making horns, I thought, well, I'll use that name. I could call it the Lane French horn, but then I could see people saying, oh, I play a lame French horn. So I thought, well, that's not a good idea for marketing. So I went with Landstro, and going back to when I was in the Navy band, we had 150 instrumentalists in the program. So we had a full-time repair guy, and he was nice enough, generous enough to spend some time with me. He was a horn player also, and he would always show me things that he was building, making parts of the horn. And so what eventually happened is I would watch him make these things, and I would go home and try to do it. And I set up a shop in my home, and it was more of a hobby than anything else. And then one thing led to another, and I started working with a local, I would call him a master craftsman. He was a person who did brass instrument repair in Washington, and he was really excellent. And I learned a lot from him. So, of course, I always wanted to build a French horn, but I never got into a position where I could do it. I built some components, and learned a lot about how tubing tapers affect this and that and the other thing, but it kind of came together over a series of years. And finally, when my son Alex started playing French horn, I thought it'd be fun to share some of that with him. And that was probably 20 years ago, I guess. And so he ended up being quite a good horn player. And the horn building kind of started advancing a little bit. And before long, it ended up being a French horn. And it was pretty good. And he was playing pretty well at the time. And he thought it was pretty good. So I thought, okay, well, maybe it is pretty good. And then the process of getting really serious about it took a number of years. And eventually, Phil Munns, the principal horn in Baltimore Symphony, tried one of my horns that had circulated in the community there. And he called me up and he said, I'm really interested in what you're doing. And so Phil really took me to the next level with horn building. What I couldn't figure out on my own, he helped me do. And it ended up with a final horn that actually had his name on it. It was the Phil Munns model. And Phil's playing principal horn in England right now in Royal Covent Garden Orchestra. But it was about probably seriously a 10-year process before the horn got to the point that it was what I would say is an instrument that a major player would use. And that's kind of where I am now. Hearing and sitting in the audience and listening to somebody play one of my instruments in a concert setting, on one hand, I'm very excited to hear it. On the other hand, I'm just worried something doesn't go wrong at the very moment they're playing an important solo, which, you know, hasn't happened as far as I know. And I'm actually in Brevard right now, and a high school player is playing one of my horns, and one of the college players is playing one of my horns, and they both are sitting at the top of the section, and they both have nice solos to play. So it's really fun to hear that.
Well, that wraps up this episode of Mission Artist. If you'd like to learn more about Andrew's work and Landstro horns, go to missionartist.org for links and information. You can also hear more from him on our previously released Summer of Music special episode. Please join us next time when we will be speaking with Andrea Blanche and Helen Neal, founders of SRQ Strong, a nonprofit organization that was created to promote community-wide trauma awareness.